We get things underway here in hour number two by welcoming into the program a documentary filmmaker who has won Emmy Awards, Peabody Awards, the Edward R. Murrow Award, a lengthy career of making tremendous documentaries, a number of them for Frontline on PBS, and long ago also had an earlier career as a child actor that we'll talk about. We're pleased to welcome to the program Stephen Talbot. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Hey, great. How are you, Rich?
We're doing very well, thank you. And we certainly want to talk about your work as a documentarian, but as a baby boomer, I have to begin with your acting career and go back to the days of Leave It to Beaver when you were Beaver Cleaver's best bud, Gilbert Bates. What was that experience like for you?
It was great. I grew up in Hollywood and Studio City, which was a town out in the valley, built up around the studio that Max Sennett had built for the Keystone Cops. And it later became a studio where Leave It to Beaver was done before we moved over to Universal. My dad was an actor, too, Lyle Talbot. He'd been a movie star with Warner Brothers in the 30s, and he went on to be a character actor on TV with the next-door neighbor on the Ozzie and Harriet show, Joe Randolph, for many, many years. Same time I was doing Leave It to Beaver. We were both sidekicks.
Well, and yeah, your dad had a tremendous career as well. Was there support? Was there pressure to get into acting? Was that something you did independent, or did the family embrace that and encourage you to have that opportunity?
That's a really good question. No, I badgered and harassed my parents until they relented and let me act professionally. They were totally into acting. My mother had been an actress herself and a singer who gave up her career to have four children and be a loving wife to my dad. She was a great mom. And my dad had one of the longest careers in show business, from when he ran off with a circus in the Midwest when he was a teenager until virtually until he died at the age of 94. He just kept working on stage and TV and in movies, especially stage and TV at the end. But they believed very heavily in education, and they really insisted that my brother and sisters and I do well in school, which we did. We were totally into being students. We loved it. But my dad always took us on the set, especially my brother and I, we're the two oldest, on the set of TV shows he would do, you know, Rin Tin Tin or Lassie, Westerns that we loved. And you know, we got the bug. Well, we sat backstage many times when he was in musicals or plays, toured around the country, and I just got hooked. I loved it. I really wanted to do it, and I begged, and finally my parents said, yeah, you can act as long as you stay in a regular school. So I never went under a full-time contract to a studio. They constantly wanted to do that with me on Leave It to Beaver, but I would basically freelance. And I'd go in, work very often between the ages of 9 and 14, 15. And then I hit high school, and I wanted to play football and hang out with my friends, and I quit.
Now, you also did a couple of episodes of Twilight Zone, and we're in the midst of putting together a special for this summer honoring Twilight Zone on its 60th anniversary. You did two episodes, Static and The Fugitive. Now, Rod Serling didn't write either of those episodes. Did you have much interaction with him?
I did. I was really lucky. The Twilight Zone was my absolute favorite show when I was a kid. It was a fantastic show, as you know, and it was also a very moral show. I think I learned a lot of moral lessons reinforced by my parents in school about how to live in the world. It was a really important series, and of course, it was just brilliantly written. And I was lucky enough to do two episodes. They were not the best episodes of Twilight Zone. One I had a very small part in, but I was just so honored to be on that show and to meet Rod Serling. In one of the episodes, he did one of his famous introductions sitting on a park bench. It was a scene, a baseball game. I was the ump of the baseball game. And He was right there, and he was great. You know, he was so smart. He was very liberal politically. He was an intelligent man. He cared seriously about issues in the world. And he was just like he was on TV in my experience as a boy meeting him. He looked like one of those characters out of Mad Men, much more serious. But you know, the thin black tie, the black suit, the short haircut, the stare. He was a chain smoker, unfortunately, which caught up with him at the end. But he was a very serious and friendly and just brilliant guy.
You also did an episode of Perry Mason, and I'm thinking back here, Steve, that between Twilight Zone, Leave It to Beaver, Perry Mason, those are three of the most iconic shows of the 1950s and 60s that are still seen on a regular basis in reruns. And I have to conclude that the only common thread is you.
Well, look, Rich, I was lucky. I was a pretty good actor as a kid. My dad and mom trained me well. I was professional. It was very exciting. And I did 50, 60 episodes of Leave It to Beaver as the character Gilbert. And Jerry and I were good friends. And that was the easiest, most comfortable show to do. They were very supportive. there were never any problems on that show. People got along. It ran really smoothly. And I really enjoyed it. But honestly, even more than working in Leave It to Beaver, I loved the variety of going from one role to another role and working in different shows. Twilight Zone, as I said, that was my favorite show on TV. It was just so thrilling to be on it at all. Perry Mason, I love Perry Mason. My dad was on Perry Mason. We often, different episodes, were in the same shows. But I worked all the time in those days. I was a busy actor, and I was fortunate enough to be on some of those great shows. Perry Mason was fantastic. Raymond Burr was such a character, an imposing presence on that show. But I was in Lassie. I was on the Donna Reed show, the Lucy show. I got to work with Lucille Ball. I had great, great experiences working as a kid actor.
We're talking with Stephen Talbot here on Downtown. Well, for a lot of people, that would be a lifetime of experiences right there. But you've had an even more memorable and remarkable career as a journalist and a documentary filmmaker. What led you in that direction?
Well, thank you very much, Rich. I partly was a product of the time. You know, there was so much interest in the world and the news, what was happening. I was an English major in college at Wesleyan in Connecticut, not too far from Maine, and I started taking film courses. I was always fascinated by film. I no longer wanted to be an actor. I think I wanted more control, but I did want to engage with the world, and I got into directing documentaries, made my first documentary at Wesleyan, and then went off and was a radio and newspaper person for a while. But starting in 1980, I got hired as a reporter and producer at KQED, the public station in San Francisco, made many documentaries there, and then really was fortunate enough to start working for Frontline in 1992, made about 11 Frontline documentaries. And then for a while, I ran a subset of Frontline called Frontline World, where we did international coverage, and I was in charge of sending people all over the world to do reporting in other countries, and that was an amazing experience.
One of your first documentaries and a Peabody Award winner was the case of Dashiell Hammett. Were you a fan of his before you made the film?
Absolutely. I'm such a fan of Dashiell Hammett. Remember, I'm an old English major, and I read all his books in college. They're mesmerizing, and I'm a total San Francisco guy. I was born and raised in L.A., but I've lived in San Francisco now for 40 years, and Dashiell Hammett is kind of the poet laureate of San Francisco, invented the modern crime story, really, and was a fascinating guy in his own life, had kind of a haunted life, but was a brilliant writer. I'm such a fan, I named my son after Dashiell Hammett. So my son is Dashiell Talbot, a lawyer.
Also, a tremendous documentary that you made was Broken Arrow, and while that was about nuclear weapons accidents, I couldn't help but think of this in light of the recent success of the Chernobyl series on HBO.
That's a really good show, isn't it?
Oh, it's great.
Chernobyl series. Yeah. Well, that was actually the first documentary I made in 1980 at KQED, and I got arrested in the process of making it. I had gotten the assignment to find out if a particular base in the Bay Area stored nuclear weapons and to find out if they were handling them safely. And I found out, yes, they have them. And I also found out, no, they weren't always handling them in the best way. And that became a very controversial documentary at first, but it caught on. And in fact, the military ended up using it as a training film for some of their people working with nuclear weapons on B-52 bases and so forth. That was quite an experience making that film.
It's remarkable how some stories come back around decades later. Back in 1996, you produced a documentary for Frontline, Why America Hates the Press. Could you have imagined then that we'd be in a world now where the leader of the free world refers to the press as the enemy of the people?
I can't believe it. I wake up every day and I can't believe it. It's shocking. It's awful. And yet, that title of that documentary is more appropriate today than it was back in the mid-90s when I made it for Frontline.
You also chronicle the story of Newt Gingrich, who's made an unlikely comeback of sorts here in recent years. What's your overall perspective on him and the career that he's put together? I look at him as a guy that, if for better or worse, I think I know where I stand on this, really drove the divisiveness that we've seen in this country in the last 30 years, starting with the Contract for America.
I think that's absolutely true. Newt himself always fancied himself, saw himself as a flamethrower, as a bomb thrower, and as a rebel. And he's also kind of a deeply troubled guy who I would see over and over in his life, personal life, as well as his career, where he would achieve a lot and then sabotage himself, do himself in. And I think that's been a pattern in his life. We called it the Long March of Newt Gingrich because he sees himself as a grand figure in history, kind of a pompous attitude, but, you know, sort of taking no prisoners and having that Long March view of even a Chairman Mao, the opposite politically, but that same, you know, I'm going to conquer the world attitude. One thing about Newt in that documentary, I had also done a film for Frontline about Rush Limbaugh, trying to understand what motivated him and his ditto head radio fans. Neither of them would speak to me in an interview. And so what I did was to interview many of their friends, associates, and relatives, especially their mothers, who were very revealing. And I learned a lot about Rush from his mother and Newt from his mother. So it's one of my truisms, my principles of journalism now. If your main character in a film refuses to talk to you, go get their mother.
That's a great idea. Absolutely. We're talking with Stephen Talbot on Downtown. One of the most powerful films you've made chronicled sex trafficking around the world. How difficult was it? How painful was it to hear the stories that you gathered for Making the Price of Sex?
That was a really hard one, Rich. That was produced and directed by an incredibly talented woman named Mimi Chakarova. She was originally from Bulgaria. I met her because she was teaching photojournalism at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, where I taught for quite a while. We had a Frontline office that was based there for many years. And so that's how we met. And she came to me and said she had been working on this story about women in Eastern Europe who were basically from very poor countries where there wasn't much work, and they were being recruited and trafficked, sexually trafficked, to the Middle East, to Turkey, to Dubai, and to other countries in the region. And she had some, you know, just heartbreaking stories and criminal activity that she was exposing. So she came to me, and we first did that as a short for Frontline on this show, Frontline World. And then she decided she wanted to make a feature documentary. So I was her executive producer, and helped her get a crew together and raise money. And she went back to that part of the world and created this, you know, really, in many ways, it's, you know, haunting and depressing, but very, very important film about women who had gone through these horrendous experiences. That became a big film on the human rights circuit, won the Best Director's Award at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival in New York a number of years ago. And again, that film's been used by the State Department and by human rights organizations around the world and governments around the world to train their staff in trying to break up these criminal enterprises of sex trafficking.
As a San Francisco guy, I have to think telling the story of George Moscone and Harvey Milk must have been a very personal mission for you.
That was one of these unusual projects that came to me from an old friend. I first moved to San Francisco in 1978, and it was a hell of a year here because it was the Jonestown, the People's Temple, you know, mass suicide and murder. Those people had mainly come from a church in San Francisco run by an absolute madman, Jim Jones. And the same week that was happening in Guyana to all these people who had mainly come from the Bay Area, this just, you know, unbelievable thing happened in San Francisco where this an ex-cop who had been a member of the Board of Supervisors here, you know, lost his mind, essentially, and went into City Hall and shot and murdered the mayor and then walked down the hall and shot and murdered the supervisor, Harvey Milk, who was famous because he was the first openly gay politician elected to office in the whole state of California. So it was just a nightmare for San Francisco. This was the fall of 1978, and I had just moved here, moved in with the woman I later married. We're still together all these years later. But at the time, I thought, oh, my God, you know, this place is out of control. I'm going to leave. I didn't. I stayed, and I got deeply interested in the politics of this city and in the history of this city.
Stephen, what is it about film that you found to be such a wonderful medium for telling these stories and for sharing this history?
It's funny, you know, I grew up reading, and I love books, and I was an English major in college, and I like to write. I really like to write. I've written all the documentaries I've ever made. Sometimes I write documentaries for other people. And I've always written news articles and feature stories off and on throughout my life. But there's something about film, and partly it's because I grew up watching old movies that my father was in. I'm a baby boomer, so I grew up watching TV. I was an actor as a kid, so I learned a lot about how films and television are made. But then because I'm also a child of the 60s, I was just drawn to the world. To, you know, the Vietnam War made me aware of what was going on in the world, and so many other things were happening in the 60s, the civil rights movement, the Kennedys, and so forth. So I just wanted to learn as much as I could, and that got me into journalism. And I tried different forms of journalism, writing, radio. Honestly, I like it all, including online journalism. But film just became my passion. And I was one of the first people at Wesleyan to get a degree. They didn't even have a program back then, but I was an English major with a minor in film, and I made my first documentary there. And I've always loved being behind a camera, directing a camera person or filming myself, and then manipulating those images. Not in a way to distort the truth, but to try to bring the truth to people. And I think film has an impact on people, visual medium, that others don't.
Well, Steve, as somebody who grew up watching black and white TV, I'm a big fan of your early work, but as someone who is a history teacher in my day job, I'm an even bigger fan of the work you've done telling these great stories through your documentaries, and it's been wonderful for us to catch up with you this afternoon.
Thank you very much. It's been good talking to you. As you can tell, I like to talk about this.
Well, we love it. Hope you'll come back again sometime.
Okay, you take care, and hi to everybody in Maine.
We will do that. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Okay, take care.
Stephen Talbot here on Downtown.